welcome to a study of the Book of Ephesians. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he talks about the purchase price for our redemption. Here's Dr. Ken Boa.
We're continuing now on our study of the Book of Ephesians, and we move from the role of the Father that we saw developed in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 3 through 6, where we saw that He is the one who, in fact, loved us, who chose us, who adopted us. So He is the one, then, a loving Heavenly Father who wanted us enough to choose and adopt us into His family. And so this gives us a fundamental ground for security, because here we have a Father who, unlike so many earthly fathers, is one who loves us unconditionally, without any limit, and also it's not based upon our performance or our own excellence, but rather on His grace and His love. And this gives us a fundamental vision of what a Father is meant to be, one who chooses us, one who loves us, one who is, in fact, using the Roman imagery, adopting us from a former household of slavery now into a household in which we now attain and gain His name, His inheritance. All the previous debts are now cleared, and He has a new identity and a new dignity and a new destiny. All of that is found in that role of the Father in verses 3 through 6. And then we move, after He says, to the praise of the glory of His grace, He moves into verse 7 through 12, and this focuses on the role of the Son in our own salvation, in our becoming people who are members of God's family. And here He speaks of the fact that in Him we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of His grace, which He lavished upon us. In all wisdom and insight, He made known to us the mystery of His will, according to His kind intention which He purposed in Him, with a view to an administration suitable to the fullness of the times, that is, the summing up of all things in Christ, things in the heavens and on the earth. In Him also we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to His purpose, who works all things after the counsel of His will, to the end that we who were the first to hope in Christ would be to the praise of His glory. I want to focus in on a particular word this morning that is seen after speaking about the kind intention of the Father's will, who would send the Son into the world. He freely bestowed us, His love upon us in the Beloved. In Him we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses. Now, there's a very rich image, this notion of redemption, that I want us to explore together, because it has a huge implication for the nature of our own journeys together in this world. The imagery of redemption would have been very familiar to Paul's audience. In the Roman Empire, there were something like 6 million slaves, something on the order of 6 million slaves, and it was possible for a slave to be redeemed, that is to say, to be set free, to buy back for the purpose of setting free. And there was a practice that was called apollotrosis. And it's from lutrao. There's this Greek word that speaks about the setting free. And apollotrosis meant that there was a practice whereby some would actually go to the slave market and purchase a person off the block, and then they would use that opportunity to literally set him free rather than buying him for himself. That was a practice that some did. And this became increasingly common with the Christian community, where they began to do this more and more frequently. And this practice is illustrative because there are different words that are used in the Greek to speak about our redemption. And one word speaks about the condition of slavery. Another one speaks about the purchase price itself. And another one speaks about the actual setting free. So there is this kind of a multifaceted dimension. This is a metaphor that would clearly and easily have been understood by these people at that time. And this idea of slavery is actually an image that's apropos to our predicament. Because, in fact, apart from the sun, we're all involved and we're all enslaved in the bondage to sin, to death, to the law, to the world, to the devil. This imagery in the New Testament is one whereby we have found ourselves enslaved to these forces, and we seem to have no real freedom to be set free from that corruption, that bondage, that slavery, on our own initiative, in our own power. There's someone else who must pay that price. On my Monday night study, I teach, I'm working my way through each book of the Bible, and I'm doing a visual overview of each of the books of the Bible. And in that study, we just did a presentation of the book of Ruth. And I'm stunned again at the imagery of what Messiah was, in fact, intimated as being, namely the Goel. And the Goel, G-O-E-L, is used 13 times in the book of Ruth. In that small little book, this word is used. And it's a word that means kinsman redeemer. And it's an interesting, intriguing idea because Ruth and Boaz, as we study the story, became Ruth's kinsman redeemer. And he was a blood relative of Naomi, and he elected to pay a price and ultimately to redeem Ruth and Naomi, effectively, from their bondage and to put them into his own family. And it's a beautiful image. And I view this as a type of Yeshua HaMashiach. I see this as a type of Messiah because the messianic imagery one is clearly throughout the Hebrew Bible seen to be one of being the Redeemer, the one who would pay, the one who would purchase us. Isaiah 53 is about as clear an example as we get of that imagery. And what I see here is four things about the Goel that are significant, that relate to Messiah. The first thing that a kinsman redeemer had to be, like a Boaz, number one, he had to be a blood relative. That's the first thing. He had to be related by blood. I find that significant because, indeed, the Son of God became the Son of Men so that the sons of men could become sons of God. He became one of us. Taking humanity up into himself now, he has become our blood relative. He has become our near kinsman. And in that beautiful image then, by his solidarity with the human condition then, he has in fact become now one who is in a position to redeem us. Indeed, that's the purpose for which he came. That's why the Gospels all build up climactically to this image of increasing rejection and opposition, but Jesus knows the purpose for which he came was, in fact, to set his people free from their sins. And at Advent, we celebrate that idea where he was prophesied as being the one who would set his people free from their sins, the purpose for which he would come and give us that that redemption. Not only did he have to be a human, that he had to have solidarity with the human condition, but furthermore, the Redeemer had to be not only a close relative, a blood relative, but he also had to be able to redeem. That's the second thing about a Goel. He had to be able to redeem. He had to have the resources necessary in order to pay the price of redemption for the one who was, in fact, enslaved, and to set them free. So he had to be able to do so, had to have the resources. And again, Jesus, not only as man, but as God, was in a position to do that. And third, he had to be willing to redeem. It's one thing to be a near or a blood relative. It's another thing to be able to do it. But there is a third dimension of willingness. And in fact, there's in the Levitical law a description about one who would be a kinsman redeemer who elects not to raise up to his deceased relative family in his name. Such a person then would elect not to do so. In fact, we see that in the book of Ruth, where the guy, the nearest redeemer, decides not to do so. But this one is not only a near relative, not only able, but also third, willing to redeem. And then the fourth thing about the Goel is that he also had to be free himself. He could not be in a context of slavery or bondage himself. This is very significant because when it comes to Jesus, he's the only one who was free from the bondage of sin. He, through the virgin birth then, did not receive the Adamic nature, but rather he was one who, fully God and fully man, did not actually participate, though, in the whole idea of imputed sin that came from Adam's race all the way down to our own present time, which would be communicated by one generation to the next, that each of us would be born in a context where we received that nature. It was put on our behalf. It was imputed to us effectively. And here is one, the only one, who was actually in this world free from that bondage. He himself was free from sin. In him there was no sin. Now he was tempted in all ways as we are. Scriptures make that very clear, being fully man. He was temptable. And he was tempted in all ways as we are, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life. And indeed, that's precisely what Satan uses in the temptation scene there in Matthew 4 in order to try to bring him down. He uses the lust of the flesh, turn this bread, these stones into bread. Remember, he waited until he was pretty hungry, 40 days and 40 nights. And then he appeals to that. And he appeals to bypassing God's purposes, effectively. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, he shows him all the kingdoms of the world and says, these are going to be yours if you worship me. And the lust and the pride of life, the boastful pride of life, throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple and show who you really are. And he was susceptible. He was one who could be tempted in all ways as we are. Adam was tempted in the same way, Adam and Eve, in the garden. What were the three temptations? They looked at the fruit, and it was desirable to eat, the lust of the flesh, and it was appealing to the eyes, the lust of the eyes, and the appeal to pride. It had the power to make one be as God, knowing good and evil. This is a pretty consistent strategy, guys, and you will be tempted in these same three ways, I promise you. Money, sex, and power have a certain pull in our lives. I spent 30 sessions not long ago going through money, sex, and power, approximately 10 sessions on each. For some reason, you were interested. I'm not sure why, but... And by the way, for those of you who didn't hear that series, it's all archived, and Dick Walters, I owe a lot to you for... where are you, Dick? For your kindness in making this possible, where he actually videos both this and also my Sunday morning class. And that's a great ministry. And Dick goes to the trouble of doing that, and he puts it up on our website. And it's archived over 3 years now, wouldn't you say, Dick, for this Wednesday morning group, a weekly video. And then the Sunday mornings are pushing 2 years as well. So you can actually go back, and it's archived, and you can find all that. But I feel that this whole issue of money, sex, and power, this idea of temptability, is critical. And we see in Hebrews chapter 2 and also in Hebrews 4 where he was tempted in all ways as we are, yet without sin, so that we could have a faithful and merciful high priest that we could go to in time of need because he understands what it is like to experience the human condition with all its weakness and all its frailty. He understands that. Because he became one of us. And yet he overcame sin, and though he was tempted, yet he did not succumb. And therein lies his freedom for him to be capable of doing that for us as well. So this is a beautiful image in the Goel, in the book of Ruth, about what Jesus would ultimately be for us. And so there would be this imagery then of the price of redemption. And really this enslavement then, what he did then was set us free from various things when he purchased us. In fact, the purchase price of this redemption turned out to be his own blood. If you turned with me to Philippians chapter 1, I'm sorry, I'm saying Philippians, I mean 1 Peter. And in 1 Peter chapter 1, you see this purchase price. He says, knowing, and this is verse 18, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers. That's a good summary right there. You actually inherited a life of futility, of vanity that would lead only to death and separation from God because of the Adamic nature. That's what you inherited from your forefathers. All of us are in that condition. And this is that was 1 Peter 1:18. So you were not redeemed with just money. That would never be enough. But rather it says with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. And here he's using the imagery of the Passover lamb. And at the Passover ceremony then, it was really a recollection of the idea that there would be a Passover lamb who would, in fact, the blood of the lamb then, that sacrificial blood, would take the place of the people. And those who, sacrificed the lamb, which, by the way, had to be in the prime of its life, 1 year, and it had to be spotless, that is, and it's a metaphor for being sinless and so forth. It had to be done in the middle of the evenings. It had to be done between 3 and 6 in the afternoon is when it would be slain. And it would be slain on the 14th of Nisan, which was the month of Passover and the day of Passover. By the way, Jesus, in the prime of his life, who was sinless, was in fact slain between 3 and 6 in the afternoon. He died on that very day. This is not an accident. He fulfills the Passover imagery perfectly. And the price he pays is not something that would be inadequate, like silver or gold. None of that would suffice, but rather with his own blood. And this is an image then of something precious, unblemished, spotless. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory so that your faith and hope are in God. So thus we have been effectively purified, and we have been thereby declared righteous. That which we had, he takes upon himself. So in this mysterious and profound act of redemption, we have him now by the same principle that condemned us, the same principle redeems us and puts us in a right stead before God. Namely, the principle of imputation where we received Adam's nature, now the same principle, he imputes his new nature to us. He puts it in our account. Remember the verse that I so often like to quote to you in 2 Corinthians 5:21, he made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And so in that beautiful image then, the Father made the one who knew no sin to become sin so that ultimately we who were sinners would actually be set free. That is to say, who knew no sin, and that he would take it upon himself. And in this imagery there, then, there's this double imputation, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. So he takes our sin and in return gives us his righteousness. That's the genius of it all. It's not something we could ever earn or achieve or merit. If indeed it were possible for us to attain righteousness by the works of the law, by the works of human endeavor, then Christ died needlessly, as Galatians makes clear. But it was needful because there was no one who could actually escape from that bondage to sin. Indeed, the problem Jesus clarified was the problems in the heart itself. From the very heart of man that comes all these issues and these wickedness. So even if you cleaned up your outward act, which you really can't do perfectly, you would still have this fundamental problem within. Here now, Jesus takes from us and takes the burden of our sin and becomes the sin bearer. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And then in turn gives us on the cross his righteousness. So he not only takes something from us, but he also gives something to us, the best deal you'll ever get. And herein lies the genius, the uniqueness, the mystery of how a holy and righteous God could declare unholy people righteous, because he's now changed our very nature, given us a new heart, and transformed us now from the inside to the outside. And this is the genius, this is the method that he uses that is apart from our own merit or attainment. It is, in fact, the grace of God. It's an incredible concept that he would love us this much. And when I think about this idea then, we are people who are doubly owned. I like to tell the story about a young boy who lived in a New England seaport. And he loved to watch the boats come in from their daily catch. And one day he decided to go ahead and build a little sailboat of his own. And he spent weeks, because he wanted it to be just right. He wanted it to be something then that he could use and put in the water, and something that really looked realistic. And the day arrived where he was ready. And he brings it out to the water, proudly puts his boat into the water. And as he observes his new sailboat, something awful happens. There's a sudden shift in the wind, and the tiny boat is brought out into the water beyond his reach, and effectively disappears. Day by day, he would go back to try to find his boat, but he could never find it. After a few weeks, he found his boat, but it was in the window of a store, and it was being sold. Now, he went in there and said, "That's my boat." He said, "I made that myself." And the shopkeeper said, "I'm sorry, but you're going to have to pay $2 for that boat." And he, in spite of all his objections, basically gave in, and he came up with the $2, and he purchased the boat that he himself had made and took it out of the shop. And then he said to that little boat, he says, "Now you are doubly mine, because you're mine because I made you, and now you're mine because I bought you." Do you see the imagery there? That is God with us. He doubly owns us, insofar as he not only made us by virtue of creation, but he doubly owns us because he now bought us. And that, to me, is a metaphor, an image of what that is all about. Now, when I was a kid, I remember this idea of redemption. Even before I was a believer, I had some idea, some notion of redemption. I'm old enough to remember the green stamps program. You remember that those programs there? And my mom, you know, you'd go, what was the name of the company, H&H? S&H. Boy, a lot more of you are old enough than I am to remember. Yeah, old crowd, S&H green stamps. Those of you got to be at least 50 to know about this program here. And S&H green stamps, my mom would, wherever she would shop then, collect these green stamps, and she would get a certain number of them according to her purchase. And then it was my job, when she got a big sack full of these things and she get the little books, I had the somewhat unpleasant job of having to stick them in there, you know, glue them into the little books, which was a good deal of trouble. I think that they were counting on most people not going through the effort of doing that. That's how I view it anyway. And so I would glue these things into book after book after book until she finally had a big enough collection that she would go to the S&H green stamp, what did they call it? Redemption Center. They actually called it a redemption center. So I had an idea about redemption, you see. And what did you do? You went and took those stamps and you redeemed something. Something that had worth, and you'd get these little odds and ends. I remember going into the shop once in that redemption center. I couldn't see one thing I wanted. It's full of junk. But nevertheless, you know, some people wanted that stuff. And I remember getting odds and ends and so forth, and she would go there and get something. And I was fascinated by that notion that you would actually effectively pay a price for it, that is to say, through your purchases. And then you owned it, in effect, but you hadn't redeemed it. In other words, you had the potential ownership of certain items that corresponded to what you'd purchased. But then you'd have to formally go there and then give those green stamps into the hands of those people. And that's an interesting notion to me. And it's really very, very similar. That concept is then something that I think is very, very similar to this metaphor of redemption. Yes, question.
That was one of Warren Buffett's first big investments.
Was that one of Warren Buffett's big investments? Now, there's a bit of trivia that I'd never know about. See, you learn some every day, you know? Interesting deal. And yeah, I don't know when it quit, when they stopped that program, but it was pretty successful for a good while, Joe.
I have an interesting interpretation here. It says, realizing that you were ransomed for your feudal conduct.
Yeah, it's a ransom. In effect, we hear about ransom money. It's the payment price. The ransom actually is the price itself. The redemption is the setting free. And so the redemption incorporates those words I described before, agorazo, ex agorazo, neutrao, those words that mean basically that you had the redemption price, agorazo, ex agorazo would be then you pay the price and then neutrao, you set them free. And so the idea here is that it's a multifaceted process that speaks not only of being in the slave market of sin, but then the redemption price, and then the setting free. And so ransom's not a bad, it's a good cognate word for that. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, over there.
I was reading and listening to some of the results of the gift card purchases people make, and of course give primarily between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And there's a significant number of those gift cards that are purchased that are never redeemed. And it occurred to me that's very similar to the possibility of redemption
to God. Actually, Ben, that's a good analogy. Do you hear what he was saying about gift cards that are never redeemed? They're already purchased, but somebody has to actually redeem it in this case. So there's an imagery here where he's purchased us, but still there's a need for somebody to respond to that initiative. It's not going to just be foisted upon us. That's where our recall then for us is, how do we respond to such an offer of redemption? And a person can say no and not even bother purchasing that. But once that occurs, though, we now become a person who is different. We have been changed and we've become a new creation. And now we have this new dimension in us that we did not have before. But there's still the old, the remnant of the old Adamic nature. There's still this remnant of our mortality in Adam. And that's why, in a way, we're a walking civil war. And perhaps you've all noticed this. There's that in us that is in warfare with another thing that's in us. But I want to stress, it's not the deepest you against the deepest you. Then we'd be truly schizophrenics. But rather, it is the deepest you versus the remnant of what you were, what Paul calls the flesh, the outer man. In the inner man, you are righteous, and that new nature is such that in your spirit never needs to be changed, because God declares us righteous. But in our outward man, we find that we sometimes succumb to these old pulls that were there, because we still have this remnant, this thing that Paul struggled with in Romans 7 called the flesh. And it's something that is going to be a warfare, a struggle that we have, but he's given us the weapons of the warfare, and he's given us the power so that we can know we are capable of overcoming the power of sin through the blood of the Lamb. Yes?
The Greek word that describes the inner man.
He's talking there about, there's actually a word when he talks about anthropos, he talks about the inner and the outer. And he's using the idea of the deeper self. And he says, let me just give you that idea, and we'll quit because we're out of time. Where he says, I'm no longer the one doing it, but the sin which dwells in me. I find then the principle that God is present with me, the one who wants to do good. I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man, but I see a different law in the members of my body. The same words used, but he relates one to the inner, and then the other he relates to the outward. in the outer, but it's the idea of the inner self, you could almost say, versus the outer self. And then the members of my body, he says, I see this war making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members. So you have this struggle that we all encounter. And that is the dimension between the deepest us and the new persons, what we've become. Thanks be to God, this warfare will be over. And that will be over when we are actually at the Bema, the judgment seat of Christ, where we will then be stripped of that. And then all that we are, not just our spirit, but also our souls and our bodies, will be made perfectly compatible with the image of Jesus. So I look forward to that day. I've told you before, I'm terrified of it, and I look forward to it. Terrified because it's not going to be some easy thing to stand before Jesus. You know, the phrase that I like to use, it's easy to lip sync in the chorus of life. And it is. But each of us is going to have to sing solo before him. And that, then you have nowhere to go. You have nowhere to escape. Nevertheless, I look forward to it because there he will remove that, and all that remains then will be that which is good. And so I look forward to it. It's like T.S. Eliot put it. He says, I had far rather live as I do, in daily terror of eternity, than to think that this was merely a child's game in which everyone would get equally worthless prizes in the end. You see the idea? This is more than a child's game. This really matters. This counts. Right now counts forever. And so what we do with this redemption, how we respond to God's overture of redemption, has everything to do then with the ultimate destiny in this world, which is a soul-forming world. This is not our home.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.